I wouldn't do it if I didn't think that, Paul. even if I didn't, I have a good PR team that can
okay.
write the record.
Oh. Folks, I'm opening the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency on December 9th, 2014. Welcome, everyone. And I am hoping that all of you folks can stay until 4. We're planning on having the work session at the end, but we need to have 5 in order to pass the LCs. So we don't need to go out of order here.
Unless you want to do it now.
I think we'll do it now.
Unless just if some people might be running late.
Yeah, I think we'll wait and stick to the agenda unless anyone's running out. But love to have Patrick Allen, director of DCBS. We're in for an overview of the agency. Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and happy to come today and give you a little bit of an overview of how we approach consumer protection in the agency. What we'll do is talk a little bit about our approach to consumer protection and how we're structured to deliver those services, and then highlight a few key initiatives that we have going on right now in that area, and see if there are any questions or discussions that you want to have that go from there. DCBS is, with a staff of about 900, Oregon's largest consumer protection and business regulatory agency. Just from a general structure standpoint, we do a lot of the general business regulation that's not sort of natural resource permit related and those kinds of issues. Our mission is to protect and serve consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. We really kind of think of that as a two-part mission, both parts of which are equally important, protecting consumers and workers. That gets at worker safety issues. That gets at financial consumer protection. It also gets at things like building codes issues around building safety and those kinds of things, but also supporting a positive business climate. And just a couple of quick points about that, because I'm not going to dwell a lot on that, but I think it's important not to move by it too quickly. First, in terms of a positive business climate, we believe one of the most important consumer protection tools are competitive marketplaces for the goods and services that Oregonians need, and so having a wide array of services and people competing for their business, we think itself is a way to assure consumer protection. So, as an example, Oregon has according to the American Medical Association, we have the most competitive health insurance individual health insurance market in the country, with over a dozen companies providing literally dozens of different kinds of plans at a range of coverages and prices, and as a result, we have some of the lower individual insurance rates in the country. Similarly, we have an active credit union market, active banking markets, those kinds of things. We think that's a valuable piece of the regulatory pie. Let me talk a little bit about just generally the tools that we use and how we approach regulation. We kind of think of a three-legged stool in the agency around licensing, standards, and education, and I'll talk just a little bit about each of those. Most of the regulatory authority that you have given us historically over time are in incremental slices where you have told us there's an industry that you want to have regulated. You've given us the authority to license participants in that industry, and that may be a single license for a single activity, or that may be multiple licenses for multiple activities within a single industry. You've usually in statute, but sometimes by rule, given us the authority to charge a license fee and then use the money from those licenses to basically be the cop on the beat on whatever that beat is, from insurance agents to plumbing contractors to pawn brokers to banks and credit unions. That's got some pros and cons to it, and probably the biggest con is it's a fairly inherently siloed kind of an approach. We can't use the money from regulating electricians to regulate plumbers. We can't use the money from regulating credit unions to regulate banks. Now, I think generally we've gotten used over the years to working within that kind of a system, being able to make some fairly flexible kinds of decisions. But that's sort of the nature of how that structure works. Setting and enforcing standards is the is the second. Well, I mean, let me stop. In terms of licensing, then a lot of our enforcement work is around people either exceeding the terms of their license or operating without a license, and that varies depending on the topic area we're talking about. Often in financial scams, the thing that we're actually going after someone for is selling financial products without a license. Although the underlying issue is that they're really not selling a financial product at all. But we'll, if you see the civil penalties or those kinds of things that we assess, that's what we're typically doing, is that they're selling unregistered securities without a securities dealer license or something along those lines. Just as an aside, when you think about, I think there's some work being done right now having to do with collection of debt that's owed the state. That's an area where I've seen civil penalties that we've assessed that are six and sometimes even seven figures, not because we think we're ever going to get that money back from somebody, but we want the first thing that shows up on a Google search to be this guy got fined $500,000 for selling fraudulent securities or those sorts of things. The other issue, the leverage that this gives us in terms of behavior in the marketplace is the license itself. The ability to suspend or revoke a license is a powerful tool and helps us deal with enforcement issues and have some leverage. All right, to standards.
Wait, question.
Can yes, I answer? I'm sorry.
I have a question. So, all of that makes great sense. So I'm trying to understand. So how do you identify those if they don't have a license to begin with? Mm-hmm. So is it complaint basis, or how do you find out?
Yeah, thanks. Chair Kindergeyer, Representative Lively. A combination of inbound complaints that we'll receive as well as becoming aware through media. We found ourselves watching TV ads on late night TV thinking, well, that's kind of interesting. I wonder how they're doing that. And actually going off and pursuing cases as simply as that. Mm-hmm. Setting standards takes a variety of forms. There are highly formalized standards like the building code. There's not actually the building code is kind of a misnomer. There are actually about seven discrete codes that govern how buildings are built. So a plumbing code and an electrical code and a mechanical code and so on. Mm-hmm. We set those standards, and in the case of building codes, we delegate authority to cities and counties to be the ones on the ground who, in most cases, review plans and go out and do inspections and those sorts of things. We have standards for the operation of financial organizations, banks, credit unions, insurance companies. Here, one of our important consumer protection tools is assuring the safety and soundness of the financial institution to be able to meet whatever obligations it's made. So the bank is there to pay its deposits. The insurance company is there to pay claims. And so a lot of our regulatory consumer protection work is around audits and assessments and inspections to assure that those businesses are being operated in a manner consistent with our standards. And then similarly, although we aren't talking today a lot about the workers' compensation and workers' safety system, workers' compensation is an insurance product, and we have, through a separate set of statutes, extensive standards about how those insurance companies are supposed to approach claims for workers' compensation insurance, for medical treatment, for replacement wages if someone is disabled, and all those kinds of issues. And then the last leg of the stool is education and advocacy, and I'm going to come back to this again give you a couple of examples of some of the things that we do. But this ranges everywhere from very retail functions like our injured worker ombudsman, who's got a staff dedicated to taking calls from people who have been injured on the job. The workers' compensation system, if you've never engaged it at the retail level, is in fact, highly complex. And it can be difficult in complex cases to negotiate on your own as an injured worker. We don't provide legal advice, but we are able to help people negotiate that process and be able to get to good outcomes. Through our Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program, SHIBA we call it, we're able to provide retail assistance to senior citizens trying to negotiate the complex web of Medicare as well as Medicare supplements, Medigap policies, and those kinds of issues. And then we do things like scam alerts, press releases on enforcement actions that we've taken, and those kinds of things to try to improve consumer awareness of the work that we do. So that's kind of our philosophical approach to the work we do. Let me talk about how we're organized to do this. We have really what I would call five key programmatic divisions. In most cases, these divisions actually have existed at some point in the past as independent agencies. And so our structure as an agency is a little different in that we're kind of this amalgamation. It's almost sort of a corporate holding company kind of an approach in that they've each got distinct statutes that regulate the insurance code or securities law or the building code. But we operate across those organizational lines to try to focus on consumer protection. A couple of additional pieces. We've got a central services division that provides the business services across the entire agency. And then there's you'll see a dashed line linkage to the Workers' Compensation Board. The Workers' Compensation Board is actually an independent agency headed by the chair of the Workers' Compensation Board. They are the adjudicatory body who make decisions regarding workers' compensation and Oregon OSHA cases. We provide them administrative services, but the chair of the board, who's appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, independently runs that unit. Now, you'll see in the lower left here, we're going to kind of continue the theme of the organizational structure, but then highlight a couple of pieces of it to talk in a little bit more detail about what we do. The insurance division really has a primarily a dual regulatory role. It's there to ensure the financial safety and soundness of insurance companies to make sure they can pay claims. And it also has a responsibility to make sure that individual consumers are being treated fairly by those who are dealing within the insurance industry, whether that's insurance agents, insurance companies through the Fair Claims Practices Act or other standards that we have. We have a vigorous consumer advocacy function. We have a team of advocates who receive inbound calls from people who are having challenges with their insurance company, and we provide actual retail one-by-one assistance to those folks. It takes a variety of forms. It can range from helping them understand why something's not covered in their policy, if it in fact isn't, to a kind of a soft approach to a company saying, "Hey, could you take another look at this issue? Because you know we think there might be another way to look at this." To forwarding cases on to our enforcement team to actually look at either individualized or widespread market conduct issues, and so that's led to things like within the past year, significant decisions against, for instance, a life insurance company exhibiting a pattern of marketing inappropriate products to senior citizens and those kinds of issues. And I'll come back again to the advocacy function, because we have a significant campaign that's out right now. Come to it right now. Over about the past 9 months, we have been promoting access to these advocates in a significant way. We accessed a pool of about potentially, we've not spent all of a pool of about $2 million of money that over the years we had accumulated from settlements with companies engaged in illegal behavior, and each of these settlements had often had a fairly Byzantine set of restrictions on what we could or couldn't use it for. Staff in the past year in the insurance division got really creative and went back to those settlement agreements and those companies, and we're able to actually break those open and get them to be much more broadly used. And so we've been able to pool them and promote access to advocates. We think this is important for a couple of reasons. One, they do good work. They recover millions of dollars for Oregon policyholders on claims that should be paid and issues that should be dealt with in accordance with the code. But it's also free. This, in many cases, can displace the need to go pursue an attorney to try to file a claim and the cost and time that takes. And we think it's really effective. Here's an example of one of the media placements, and you may well have seen some of these. We've been active with billboards, with bus advertising, magazine placements. We did a little bit of TV back in the spring last year. We've done a fair amount of radio, where you basically just get an audio with this. The media itself has been very inexpensive media. The production values look good, but they're cheap. There's not voice actors and those kinds of things, or there's not live action acting. There's basically stills with content. That's also mean we've been able to be a little bit flexible with what the content is exactly. I know one question that's come up: if when you place a package of radio advertising, you end up buying radio advertising on Oregon Public Broadcasting, which sounds a lot like a government agency sponsoring OPB. From a marketing standpoint, it's an ad is an ad is an ad, but that's where that has cropped up as well. Health insurance rate review is another significant piece of work the insurance division does around consumer protection. This is work that we were doing in Oregon before the passage of the Affordable Care Act. There have been changes to our system, but not complete shifts in how we do this business. It's really been the details of how it's executed. This chart is just a graph for 2015 of some work that we did to try to figure out how can we easily for consumers display a range of information about some of the choices they have available in individual healthcare markets. And so this is a representation of bronze, silver, and gold plans across a variety of carriers. I think this is in the Portland area. We give a key that is an idea of what those different plan colors mean, and then what the various rates are and what the changes have been. But this has actually taken some work to try to figure out what are some effective ways to present this information, because it's actually really complex across a dozen companies, with each company having multiple filings in different kinds of products and age groupings and those kinds of things. So back to that consumer education notion, how do we make this information accessible to consumers, as well as fulfilling our regulatory role to make sure that rates are high enough to be able to assure that the company can pay claims, but low enough that they're affordable for consumers. And then just another issue to touch on, we've issued a number of insurance bulletins, and I've highlighted some of them here. And these are ways that we communicate to the insurance industry to assure that they have an understanding of what our regulatory position is on issues like gender identity, applied behavior analysis. This is a bulletin that we're in the process of issuing right now that stems from a court case that was decided over the summer in federal court around coverage of a particular treatment for mental issues. These are ways that we communicate these kinds of issues. Let me shift over to finance and corporate securities. This is the other major consumer protection piece of the organization. It's also financial regulatory. Very much this is about regulating the safety and soundness of financial institutions in the form of banks and credit unions. Banks and credit unions are an area where we share regulatory authority with the federal government. All the stuff I talked about in insurance, that's solely state regulatory authority. In the banking and credit union world, there's what's called a dual regulatory system, and that means there's always a deposit insurance regulator, and then in addition to the deposit insurance regulator, there's either a state or federal regulator. If you're a nationally chartered bank, you're going to be regulated by some combination of the Comptroller of the Currency and the Federal Reserve, and or at the state level, you're going to be regulated by us if you're a state chartered bank, and we have a number of state chartered banks in Oregon, Umpqua being the best known and largest of them at about $20 billion in assets. So the fact that you're a state chartered bank is not at all equivalent with being a small bank or a large bank necessarily. And in fact, in credit unions, the pattern in Oregon is that the federally chartered credit unions tend to be the smaller credit unions, and the state chartered credit unions tend to be the larger ones. We also regulate a wide array of financial products and services that range from large elements of what we do around mortgage lenders and consumer lenders to fairly small and specialized programs like pawnbrokers, money transmitters, check cashers, and those kinds of things. And in those cases, what we're really regulating are a set of acceptable business practices and standards that they have to meet in the marketplace. I think you've got a brochure there at the table on Bank on Oregon. This is an initiative in this area. This is an effort to partner with a number of banks and credit unions in the state to deal with a fairly persistent issue that has had a regulatory element historically around check cashing and costs and fees and practices around the check cashing industry. But it really is focusing on how do you facilitate people being able to be banked. If you've read anything about the phrase often that gets used is the high cost of poverty, not having access to a bank account, it, in fact, actually raises your cost of doing a whole variety of things. And I think that gets touched on in one of the back pages of the brochure. The cost to cash your paycheck and to buy money orders to pay your utilities and all those sorts of things make not having access to a bank account very expensive. And so we've partnered with a number of banks and credit unions to combine access to low-cost checking and savings account services with financial education tools to help people deal with issues that if they don't manage them well, can keep them from having access to banking services. And so, someone is in a position that they can't manage their money and they bounce a bunch of checks and get their account closed, that actually becomes a barrier to then being able to open an account elsewhere. And so this is an effort to try to deal with some of those kinds of issues. We've also done a fair amount of work around around payday lending. We license payday lenders in the state of Oregon, and there are standards that they then have to follow in terms of things like what's the maximum fee they can charge for a payday loan, what's the maximum amount of a loan that can be issued, how long can the loan last. They're not allowed to be able to roll loans over or have partial payments or those sorts of things. And those are protections that if you are in a position to need these kinds of services, minimize the financial impact of them. We've done some work in the past year focusing on the risks of using unlicensed payday lenders, and there are a couple of wrinkles to this. Of course, the internet is a wonderful thing, including as a tool to try to get around state regulations, and so trying to help people understand that there are added risks and lacks of protection in using using unlicensed lenders is an issue. It's also kind of opened up some interesting interesting insight into the area of tribal payday lending. Tribal governments, of course, aren't covered by state law or federal, by our state law. I should say this is an area that Oregon tribal governments are not involved in at all. So we're talking about either actual tribal government entities in other parts of the country or much more frequently, actually, if you'll pardon me, somebody who says he honestly has a relationship with the tribe and we're sure that his facility is on a reservation and really it's covered by the exemption from state law because it's tribal. And we've actually run into some cases where we've pursued that and been able to get some people to stop doing business in Oregon because we find they're not actually covered by those kinds of exemptions. Let me just quickly touch on some of the consumer protection legislation you're going to see from us this session. We have, I think, about 15 bills in total, not all of which are about consumer protection, but we're going to be, I was just talking about payday lending, we're going to have a concept in front of you to give us the authority or give us the legal standard that if a loan is not by a licensed lender in Oregon, the loan balance is voidable. We're asking to have some, and we'll obviously be coming back and talking about all these in more detail, but we'll talk about buy here, pay here auto dealers. This is sort of the ugly spawn of the marriage of title lending shady car sales, I guess, is the best way to put it, where you go and buy a late model or an early model high mileage car, and they finance the transaction there, and they keep the title there, and they write the paper at rates that are abusive, and lo and behold, you've suddenly got your car repossessed, and their business model is on the volume of transactions, and this really falls between some cracks right now in regulatory oversight, and we ask for some authority to deal with that. But there are a number of other issues, and I won't go into detail on all of them, but it gives you some flavor of the kinds of things that we plan to come back and talk about in the 2015 session. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you've got.
Any questions? Representative Holby.
Just wanted to comment, or maybe you could comment on your ability to help consumers get restitution or recover and costs that they've incurred from scams or other things.
Yeah,
or
thanks.
Whether that happens in the insurance division, finance, securities.
Sure. Thanks very much, Chair Kindergeyer, Representative Holvey. Yes, we do have that authority, and in fact, it was just recently added as authority in the insurance code. Prior to that addition, which was in the last full session, we had the ability to issue civil penalties to a company, but we couldn't do what struck me when I learned that we didn't have the authority as a fairly logical thing was, in addition to fining you for behaving badly, ordering that you have to actually pay the claim. And we now have that authority. We've been in a somewhat lengthy process since that law became effective to negotiate the rulemaking on that, and so I can't point to extensive use of that authority yet. We're coming out of that rulemaking process now, but I think that's an important tool that we'll be able to use to deal with that. Now, the practical reality is in most regulatory circumstances, they fall into a couple of categories. One is you're talking about a legitimate entity that's out operating legitimately, and we've gotten into a dispute about how they've handled a set of claims. And we negotiate a settlement, and as a part of the negotiated settlement, we don't really need the authority to order them to pay because as a part of the settlement, that's one of the things they agree to is to pay. In the other category, our fly-by-night operations, where once you've found them and got onto what they're doing, not so much in insurance and other kinds of financial products, pardon me, the act of finding them and exposing what they're doing also drives them out of business, and so there's not often enough, there's nothing there to order to be able to make a payment. But that notion of the ability to order a restitution across our various statutes is really important and gives us an added tool that we've got to be able to help make consumers whole. I think probably some of our best track record over the last several years in that is actually in the building code area, where the approach that we've taken with unlicensed work, unlicensed plumbing or electrical work, is not just to worry about whether they were licensed and fine them for not being licensed, but also order that they go back and hire a licensed plumber or electrician to go back and redo the work so that it's done to code and properly inspected and isn't a danger to the homeowner.
Okay, Mr. Allen, this is the Bank on Oregon is a very interesting idea. Is this something that you guys have just, is this rolling out this year? Or
yes, ma'am. It's just rolling out now.
Oh, great. And how are you going to get the word out to people that really need this? Because this is a great idea.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Doherty, we're going to rely on our partners in the financial services industry largely to do the promotional work. We don't often find the magic pots of money that we've been able to on the insurance side to be able to do extensive advertising, so we won't have a large advertising budget per se behind this, but we'll also push it through social media and our other earned media kinds of ways to be able to promote them.
That's a good idea.
Thank you.
I had one quick question for you. You kind of stated where you are in the current state, and I wonder, just in terms of trends, how is the budget for you, the governor's proposed budget for you this year? Is it just a maintenance of effort? Is there a shrinkage? Is there a growth? How has it been over the last few years? And in terms of those three different categories, education, setting and enforcing standards, and regulatory, has that shifted over time, or is it relatively?
Yeah, great question. So, first to the budget. Oddly, you probably have more control over our budget than what's proposed in the governor's budget, because it's really driven by the fees, almost all of which are statutory, mm-hmm. that we collect for the activities that we do. There are some broad exceptions where we've got some abilities to control our own assessments around workers' compensation, for instance, and those kinds of things. But, so I would say that our budget largely looks like doing the same kinds of things that we have done going forward. We do have some policy option packages in. We've asked for some positions in the building codes area. In particular, that's an area that's subject to wide swings in activity. I was working directly in the building codes activity or building codes division when the economy hit the skids in 2008 and eliminated 20% of the positions in the division and laid staff off and all those sorts of things. Now the construction economy is coming back quite strongly, and so we're coming back to look for restoration of some of those positions that were eliminated previously. We're asking for some additional staffing resources in the insurance area. And then later today there's going to be a legislative concept around our inheriting a large piece of work, and there will be some budget impacts of that as well if you choose to go down that path. In terms of the mix of work, I guess I've not really thought of it in terms of what that looks like over time, so much as we've never, until the last couple of years, we've not really conceived of our work in those kinds of ways. So I'm a little bit at a loss to say what it's looked like historically, other than I think today we make a concerted effort to make sure we're investing in all of those areas.
Thank you. Okay. Yes.
I have two quick questions. One deals with banking and marijuana. It's my understanding that, with what we have chosen to do with Measure 91, we're moving on a path, but that it's basically still a cash industry because of inhibitions or restrictions federally with being able to make deposits and so forth for marijuana businesses. Is there anything going on with ECBS that will help be able to enable marijuana businesses to have a banking opportunity?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Kinnegar, Representative Richardson. We've actually got some experience with this with cross-border institutions with Washington, where they've been dealing with this since their law went into effect, and we have Oregon banks that have branches on both sides of the river. There is actually some federal guidance on some safe harbor kinds of ways to conduct business that that can allow a bank to serve the needs of an entity that that's legal within the state without running afoul of some of the currency transaction challenges that exist. And so we're going to be able to take that experience from working with those Washington branches and really port that into Oregon, because the financial circumstance really isn't terribly dissimilar between the two states.
Okay, thank you. Second question is, I was thinking about the, you know, buy here, pay here problem that exists, and I would hope that as you're proceeding with that, that you don't use a viewpoint from someone who qualifies for credit to decide what's fair for someone who doesn't volunteer or qualify for credit. I've had a constituent who's been in that business. He's actually passed away years ago now, but he said that there were customers who came in, and they were kind of like an annuity. They would just keep coming in and buying a beater, and he would sell it to them, and they would make payments every month until that wore out, and they'd go get another one. And the reason was that they had absolutely no credit, no down payment, and the only place that they could buy a car was like on his lot. And so I would just hope that we stop egregious abuse, but not make it say that we're going to enforce limits that make it unprofitable for those that are providing that kind of service to people that have very low credit, and in a sense preventing people from being able to buy a car then because of our intent to do good for what we think is in their best interest.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd go back to the statements I made about the supporting a positive business climate and the competitive nature of access to financial products and services as a key element to how we look at these regulatory issues. And so this is very much a matter of currently seeing abusive practices and not defining the entire function as an abusive practice, but seeing abusive practices within the function and not having the authority to be able to deal with it at all versus a concerted effort to say this is something that just simply shouldn't exist.
Just a quick one. Yeah, while we're on the banking theme or topic and expanding it into credit unions, I think it's correct that I think the larger credit unions are state chartered, but the smaller ones are federally chartered, which is kind of the inverse of how we handle the banking world. Why is that?
Representative Johnson, Chair Kindergarten, that's a great question. I've asked it myself, and it seems to be sort of cultural and historical as much as anything. We're seeing now some activity in some further conversions from federal charters to state charters, and this is just now wild speculation on my part, and you'd probably be better off to ask some folks from the credit unions for a more definitive answer. But I think as an operation gets more sophisticated within Oregon, it's in a better position to want to sort of compare and contrast the regulatory environment and the regulatory practices of the options that they have available to be able to figure out what's the environment that they want to deal in the most. I think the thing that ties directly into that is very, very small credit unions don't have designs around branching where larger credit unions do, and I think our approach to branching tends to be somewhat different than the federal approach to branching does. That probably drives some of it, but again, that's really kind of speculative on my part.
Thanks. Okay, last one. Yeah. Representative Olby.
Just a quick question about the buy here, pay here auto dealers. Does DCBS currently have any other regulation or oversight over auto sales, auto contracts, that sort of arena?
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, auto dealers themselves are regulated by the Department of Transportation. We'll have regulatory relationships with the underlying financial transactions depending on who they're done by. So who they're, you know, are they selling the paper to a consumer finance organization or to a state chartered bank? But this is exactly the gray area I'm talking about, where the nature of the business isn't neither fish nor fowl quite, and trying to make sure we don't have a gap where they can claim to be one or the other and thus escape needing to meet some basic standards. But in terms of auto sales itself, we don't have a regulatory relationship there at all.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks very
I know
much.
We'll be some of us will be seeing you later today.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, next we have the follow-up on the foreclosure avoidance program to see how Senate Bill 558 has been working. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Janet Borth. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice, housed in the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section, and I'm the point person for the department on the foreclosure avoidance program. I thought it might be a little helpful to briefly recap how we got to today. In the year 2012, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1552, creating a foreclosure mediation program. And the very big picture rationale behind that was the foreclosure crisis that most people would say started around 2008. And what was predominantly seen was that there was a lot of trouble getting people on the same page, getting the homeowners on the same page with their lenders, getting documents exchanged, and helping people speak the same language. That 2012 foreclosure mediation program was little used for a variety of reasons. And so in 2013, the legislature passed Senate Bill 558, which went into effect August 4th of 2013. That program requires pre-foreclosure resolution conference between a lender and a homeowner if the homeowner wants to have that conference. The lender side, will initiate a case with our contractor. Our contractor will then send a notice to the homeowner, allowing that homeowner 25 days to send in a payment and a few very basic documents. If the homeowner doesn't send in that payment in 25 days, the case is over, the lender gets a certificate of compliance and can foreclose on the homeowner. If the homeowner does send in that payment, that starts a process of document exchange between the homeowner and the lender, and the homeowner also meets with a housing counselor. And we found that housing counselors are a really important part of this process. They help bridge the gap in the different languages the different parties are speaking. And then that ultimately culminates with one or more resolution conferences between the homeowner and the lender. I have provided the committee with a handout today with a few statistics. The first figure in that handout, you have two different colored bars that show very similar things. The blue bar shows requests. That's initial requests by the lender. That includes requests that may still be in the intake process. And the red bar shows that initial notice that goes out to the homeowner that I mentioned. So once the lender has gotten all the information and the initial payment they need in, we weren't sure what sort of volume we would see when this program passed. I think it was anyone's guess. We hadn't seen very much under Senate Bill 1552. And what we've really seen from the outset, once the program got going, is cases hovering between about 800 and 1,200 a month. Sometimes it gets a little higher, sometimes a little lower. But that's certainly a robust volume. I did also provide you with a general breakdown of the program usage by beneficiary or servicer. Wells Fargo is the largest user of the program at this point, and Mr. Vasquez from Wells Fargo will be speaking with you in a moment. Turning to the next page of the handout, we've had a little over 3,000 grantors or homeowners choose to participate and pay that initial fee. That's about 23% of total cases. But if we remove what we call the adjusted participation rate, if we take away the cases where we never got good contact information, so it was just always an out-of-date address, or the homeowner is deceased, that's a 31% participation rate where folks are actually getting the notice. As far as what agreements are reached after the resolution conference, the first number I give is the number of agreements that are reached pre-conference at 118. We actually think that number is quite a bit higher. We only started tracking pre-conference agreements in May of this year, and even so, that requires some amount of self-reporting by the parties, so we think that number is probably a little bit deflated. The case does go to resolution conference, at least through November, in 862 cases, an agreement was reached, and 968 an agreement was not reached. Of the agreements that are reached, the vast majority are aimed at retention of the home. Trial period plans, that's a trial modification that will hopefully lead to a permanent modification. Next most common is a permanent modification, then reinstatement or payoff. One of the requirements of the program is that the beneficiary tell the homeowner what it takes to pay off the home, and we're seeing some good results from that. There may also be a forbearance agreement, giving the homeowner a little bit more time to come current. And early in the program, a few homeowners were able to take advantage of hardest hit funds that were administered through Oregon Housing and Community Services. We've seen a few non-retention agreements. Voluntary surrenders or cash for keys are the least common, and that's something where the homeowner just promises not to essentially fight a foreclosure and may receive a little bit of relocation money in return. There may also be a non-retention agreement to forbear proceeding with the foreclosure to give the homeowner a little more time, or short sale or deed in lieu that will allow the homeowner to repair their credit a little bit more quickly. We take surveys at the conclusion of every resolution conference. Not everybody completes those surveys, but I did want to share some of those results. 92% of homeowners rate the helpfulness of housing counseling as helpful or very helpful. 94% of homeowners are satisfied or very satisfied with the facilitator of the resolution conference. 95% of homeowners would recommend the foreclosure avoidance program to someone in a similar circumstance. And so that high recommendation rate, I think, tells me that even where homeowners aren't able to come to an agreement, that communication gap is getting resolved. Of lenders, 97% rate their overall opinion of the program as neutral or better, and 86% are satisfied or very satisfied with the facilitator of the resolution conference.
Representative Holvey?
I'm curious, and maybe Wells Fargo might answer this question, but since Wells Fargo makes up 32% of their requests, what does the pie look like of, you know, what's Wells Fargo's share of the total pie of notices sent, for example? Do we have an idea of, I mean, if you were to put that pie chart in there with all the different entities? I mean, I'm wondering why they're so high comparatively. Is that because they make up most of the foreclosure programs in the state?
I don't have the actual, I think I heard two questions, but correct me if I'm wrong, but Chair Holvey, members of the committee.
An attempt at one. But.
Okay, sorry. Wells Fargo is a large lender, so some of that is just a question of lending volume. There are a few large lenders that have been holding back a little bit more. So Bank of America has only recently started participating. So we'll see Bank of America's piece of the pie get a little larger. We'll see Chase's piece of the pie get a little larger. Does that answer your question?
I have a question before we move on. Also, just in terms of agreement rates, they don't add up to the participation rate. So what would it be the other category?
Case Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, a little over 1,000 cases are still in progress.
Still in progress, okay. Great. Any other questions before we move on? Okay, who's next?
Okay.
Welcome to Oregon.
All right.
I hear you're
you.
From somewhere else.
I'm from San Antonio, Texas.
Wow. Thank you for coming.
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Livey, Vice Chair Richardson, and members of the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. I'm Chris Vasquez, Loan Administration Manager for Wells Fargo Home Mortgage Servicing. I'm honored to be here today to discuss Wells Fargo's participation in the state's foreclosure avoidance program and how it fits our broader efforts to help our home mortgage customers when they encounter financial difficulties. We share your desire to help our customers avoid foreclosure and remain in their homes whenever possible, and look forward to continuing our work with the state in ongoing efforts to address this important issue. To start with, I would like to take a few moments to discuss foreclosure statistics in the state and within Wells Fargo's servicing portfolio. Nationwide, here in Oregon, residential mortgage delinquency and foreclosure levels have declined significantly from their peak levels. According to the Mortgage Bankers Association National Delinquency Survey, just 4.24% of Oregon mortgage borrowers were seriously delinquent on their loan payments or in foreclosure in the third quarter of 2014, which is better than a national average of 4.65%, but higher than the Pacific region rate of 2.96%. Even so, it marks a significant decrease from the peak level of 6.46% that the state saw in the first quarter of 2010. At Wells Fargo, some 97% of our approximately 166,000 Oregon mortgage customers were current on their loans or were 30 days or less behind in their payments as of October 2014. Since the beginning of 2009, we have helped or are currently in process of assisting more than 17,000 Oregon customers with an alternative to foreclosure. As a result, for every foreclosure completed in the state during that time period, we have helped or are helping two or more through alternative options. These results have not been achieved without the continued collaborative public and private sector efforts to inform customers of their options, including the introduction of the Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP, and initiatives like the state's foreclosure avoidance program. We believe that an appropriately structured mediation or intervention program can often assist in finding resolution and enable successful completion of loan modifications, and that Oregon's foreclosure avoidance program has helped Wells Fargo assist more customers more effectively. As you know, we are the largest servicer participating in the program and refer more borrowers to the program than any other company. Overall, about 1 in 5 borrowers we solicit opt into participation in the foreclosure avoidance program, and just under 2/3 of those borrowers already were working with Wells Fargo through our internal loss mitigation programs. That means, however, that roughly 1/3 were not engaged with us prior to being made aware of the state program and the opportunity we have to work with those customers as a result of the program is a very important benefit. We have incorporated the requirements of the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program into our normal borrower outreach and loss mitigation efforts and utilize the notice as an additional correspondence to create awareness to our customers surrounding the current state of their loan and the severity of the situation. To integrate the program into our processes has required that we establish specific oversight of the process and its individual requirements, as well as specialized handling throughout the process. We've also structured a number of ongoing calls and meetings with housing counselors to ensure they continue to understand the document requirements and to identify ways to streamline the process. In addition, we have regular meetings with the Department of Justice to review customer inquiries and program feedback, as well as ongoing open discussions with mediation case managers on case management issues. The role of the housing counselor in the process has helped to improve our ability to get complete and accurate documentation from our customers and to better educate borrowers about the process and its requirements. Although we have seen benefits to the housing counselor involvement, we have also had isolated issues with counselors who lack the appropriate experience and training and would recommend a more thorough approach to reviewing participating counselors to ensure they have the right qualifications. Another aspect of the program where we believe there is room for improvement is with conference scheduling. Even though Wells Fargo is the only major servicer participating in the program, we already are experiencing difficulties with scheduling conferences due to resources and time constraints, with some conferences being delayed for as much as 6 months. Finally, there are several areas where all participants in the foreclosure avoidance program would benefit from additional clarity in the definition of certain statutory terms and in the roles of the various parties in the process. These include clear definitions of what determines when a borrower has opted in to participate in the program and of the role and authority of the facilitator. We also believe that a formal appeals process, which does not now exist as part of the program, would provide a valuable means of consistently and fairly resolving any disputes that may arise. These are just a few examples of the technical changes we think would help improve the program and prevent downstream impacts once all servicers are participating. We have worked with the Department of Justice in the past to help provide better clarity to our customers through modifying the initial notice our customers receive, and we feel that similar efforts could be made surrounding these suggestions. Wells Fargo is a company committed to doing what is right for our customers. We hold ourselves to a high level of accountability for our continuous communicating with our customers and working to find ways to help them afford their monthly payments and avoid foreclosure whenever possible. In closing, while conditions have improved significantly for mortgage borrowers in Oregon and across the nation, Wells Fargo will continue to seek innovative ways to address the challenges that remain. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Today, any questions?
Good suggestions. Yeah. I appreciate the not only saying what you're doing in the program, but how you would improve it.
Thank you.
It's very important. All of us have dealt with constituents that have been in foreclosures and before this program started. And I just wish it would have been in a couple of years before.
I agree.
But thank you for suggestions.
I have a quick question. Yes, I think it's a quick question anyhow. What's the average time for a resolution or agreement to be either reached or not reached?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, right now I think we're starting to actually get more level set in regards to the population that's making it through. We're seeing close to about 4 months from the time of initiation to the time that it's going through. We are seeing that it is getting better, and I think we should start to see those level out and get a little more consistent.
Representative Holly?
Yeah, I want to thank you a lot for coming forward and participating. I note that you are the largest participant in the program, and wondering if you care to speculate why the other large lenders are not participating as much, because you seem to think that it's actually been beneficial to both your institution and the lenders as well.
Absolutely. Chair Kenny Dyer, Representative Hovey, I will tell you it was a difficult task getting this to incorporate into our current process. That may be one of the challenges that some of our other people in the industry are running into, but we are committed to the program, we're committed to our customers, and we're committed to the relationships that we're building across the state.
Well, thanks again for stepping up.
Thank you.
I agree. Thank you very much for coming all this way, for building your capacity, and for coming up with some very concrete suggestions that we
Thank
can look at
much.
Next session.
Okay. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Emily Ryman, and I work at NEDCO, the Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation, which is one of the largest providers of foreclosure counseling in the state. For the last 4.5 years, I've overseen our foreclosure counseling programs and actually have just newly stepped into the role of interim executive director. So I have also been the counseling network's representative on the Attorney General's Advisory Committee for this program. So I have a somewhat of a statewide view of the counseling network. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and most particularly for the legislature's creation of this program, the inclusion of counseling as part of the mediation process, and for your continued support for funding for the counseling network. I recognize that I would not be here today, and we would not have the robust counseling network available to Oregonians that we have today if it weren't for your support. To begin with today, I want to talk a little bit about what we're seeing in terms of economic trends and the ongoing need for this program and for foreclosure counseling services. It's true that we are beginning to see some positive signs in economic indicators, both in the declining unemployment rate and in some increasing housing prices. But we're also seeing a really high level of ongoing demand for counseling, both as part of this program and outside of the OFA program. When you look at the state of Oregon, there are still more than 22,000 homeowners who are more than 90 days delinquent on their mortgage, who are seriously delinquent. And you can compare that before the housing crisis to just a few thousand in the state. So we are coming down from the peak of those serious delinquency rates, but we have a pretty serious backlog of homeowners who are still seriously delinquent and still need that help to try to avoid foreclosure. There are also more than 41,000 homeowners in Oregon who are still underwater on their mortgage. And that's another number that we in the counseling industry track, because if you're underwater on your mortgage, you're basically one life event away from possible foreclosure. In a traditional economy, you would be able to sell your home if you could no longer afford to make the payments because of divorce or medical crisis or loss of a job. But when you're underwater and any of those life events happen, you are very likely to end up in foreclosure. That, I would also add, disparately impacts low-income families and the lower threshold of home values. So we've seen more recovery in the housing values at the upper end of the market than we have at the lower end of the market. I would also say anecdotally that although we are seeing a lot of our clients who have been able to reemploy, it is quite common at this point for them to have reemployed at a lower wage than before. I think you see that reflected in economic trends, where a lot of the new job creation are in jobs at the lower end of the wage scale. So we may have clients who have reemployed and have a chance to get a loan modification, but they don't have the income that they used to. So I think there are a lot of economic reasons that this program is still very relevant and very necessary. And we in the counseling industry tend to estimate that we'll continue to see about the level of demand that we see for counseling well into, if not through, the next biennium. I also think there's a continuing need for the program because we continue to see issues nationally in the mortgage servicing industry. That's reflected, I think, in some recent national settlements that you've probably seen in the news. And I think particularly for the non-bank servicers, there's been a heightened awareness that there are still a lot of problems for homeowners who are trying to get to a workout directly with their servicer. So I think there are reasons also for that this program remains very relevant. The good news, though, because I don't want to concentrate on the gloomy stats, the good news is that we really feel like this program is working tremendously well. I will say that I think it's working better even than I expected it to. Not only has the OFA program created very solid mechanisms for homeowners to apply for assistance, for us to trade documents with the lenders, for them to be able to communicate with us, building in the required counseling component so that homeowners are meeting with a counselor first. We can talk with them about reasonable expectations, what is reasonable and unreasonable to expect that their lender will be able to offer them, because many homeowners just don't know. We can also help them navigate the nuances of the documents that are required, and we know the lenders need them. We know there's no way around that. So we can help homeowners put together the details that we know their lender's going to need. All of those mechanisms work much better in the OFA program than they do when we're working with a homeowner who's outside of this program. In addition to just the mechanisms of the program, OFA has also created a lot of dynamics and partnerships in the state of Oregon that are beneficial to the program and ultimately very beneficial to Oregon homeowners. An example of that is that the counselors and the lender attorneys have formed close partnerships. We meet twice a year now to have roundtable discussions about how we, even though we are adversaries in this process, actually have a lot of common interest in having the process work well, in getting to performing loans when we can get to performing loans, because that benefits the lender as much as it benefits the client. And so that dialogue and that partnership, I think, has been great for helping homeowners get to resolution. I would also just compliment Wells Fargo and thank them that Wells Fargo is a great example of a lender who has really embraced this program and who has stepped up to the plate. They now have regular conference calls with us as a counseling network to talk about where issues are happening in the program and try to be able to figure out where counseling can help the program work better, where Wells Fargo can help the program work better. And that partnership is a result of this foreclosure mediation program. So I also hope that other big lenders follow suit and step up to the table in that way. I also think that the counseling network, which is overseen and managed by Oregon Housing and Community Services, is much stronger, much more robust than it was. We have more counselors available with a higher level of expertise, and the counselors are really learning the tools of this program to help the homeowners get an honest evaluation of their application. So I think all of those are directly related to the creation of this mediation program. And I think you see that reflected in the results. I also have a one-pager that you have before you. We, as a counseling network, track the outcomes specifically to clients who have worked with a housing counselor. And we track three agreement rates. We track the agreements that are reached through the traditional conference process, but we also track agreements that are reached so quickly with the lender that they never end up in conference. And we track agreements that result, even if no agreement was reached during the conference, but the homeowner continues to work with the counselor and is able to reach an agreement because of their involvement in the OFA process. And when you look at those three together, we're seeing an agreement rate of 70% amongst our clients, which I think is profoundly good. And I think where I was sort of most surprised, I expected that we would see a lot of agreements, but I'm not sure I expected quite that rate. In addition to that, about 50% of clients that don't reach an agreement in their resolution conference continue in counseling, which to me indicates that those clients actually have a shot at getting to a workout solution. We're not generally going to continue counseling a client that is just going to end up in foreclosure. We're going to continue working with them if we think an agreement is possible. So I think those are both really interesting stats. I would also, just to give a little bit of economic perspective on that, the Center for Responsible Lending a year or two back did a state-specific specific study of the cost of foreclosures to a community. In Oregon, an individual foreclosure costs the surrounding homes more than $10,000 each in equity. So if you are a neighbor to a foreclosed home, your home loses $10,000 in value by virtue of that foreclosure. So if you look at the 700 agreements we've seen so far through counseling, more than that through the program as a whole, and you multiply that out by the equity saved, even if you just look at the three most directly adjoining homes, we're saving Oregon homeowners $20, $30 million in equity already in the program, which I think is pretty fantastic. Just a quick update on the counseling network. We are pretty much at capacity, so the filing rate that you're seeing now has us fairly maxed out. We're trying to be very strategic about the how we utilize our resources best for homeowners. There's been really universal understanding in the program and recognition in the program that counselors are a key component. The lenders want us at the table. The lender attorneys want us at the table. The facilitators want us at the table. So I think that everybody's recognizing the importance of that, and we're trying to respond to that and prioritize counseling, but also prioritize being at the resolution conference itself. So as much as we're able, we're doing that. The emergency board allocated additional funding to help us continue to operate at the current level of capacity in September, which was great. They made the decision at that point to allocate enough money to get us through March. So it's not enough to continue operating at current capacity through the biennium, with the understanding that we're still watching those filing numbers very closely. And we, of course, as a counseling network, don't want to ask for funding we don't need. So the idea is that we'll be coming back in March. If numbers have stayed the same, we'll need probably $400,000 to $450,000 to continue operating through the biennium. So that's kind of where we are as a counseling agency. And to close, we actually had a homeowner who wanted to come and testify today. He unfortunately has a sick child, so he wasn't able to make it. You have his letter in front of you, but I was hoping I could just read one paragraph that I think is particularly
telling.
I'll bet
it's the same one that I picked.
Yes, it is.
I was going to read it if you didn't.
So this is a homeowner who he had been working with his lender for about 9 months before the lender initiated OPA. And then he's writing about his process in this. And he says, having an advocate in the mediation hearings was extremely helpful, not only as just having someone there to support you, but to be able to ask questions and get answers prior to having to make decisions that could impact your housing situation for a very long time. It is very intimidating to be in a room with an attorney from your lender who is well-versed and has a specific agenda, and a neutral mediator who cannot help. Without the support of NEDCO and the housing counselor, I would have likely lost my home and been unable to provide decent housing for my four children. So I think that's just a great representation. I'm sorry he couldn't be here today, and he's sorry he couldn't be here today, but I wanted you to hear his words.
I'm glad he's with a sick kid.
Yes.
Hopefully he has paid sick leave.
Thank you. All of this is, from my standpoint, very encouraging, and I appreciate all of you being here. So, Emily, I have a question, and I don't want to focus on the negative either, but you talk about the 41,000 underwater. So where's the line between underwater and in foreclosure?
So underwater simply means that you owe more on your loan than what your home is worth. So you couldn't sell it at a market rate.
At a market rate.
And be able to pay off your loan, which is why you end up trapped. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Representative Inga Peterson.
Thank you. So thank you for coming today. This has been really great because this was, I think, an important piece of legislation for a lot of us, and it's great to hear the update on where this is. I had a couple questions based on the testimony from Chris and then Emily, that maybe you can respond. So one of the suggestions that Wells Fargo had was about the training of the mediators and making sure that they're at a level to be effective advocates, I think, for the homeowners. And how do you, do you have a response to that? Do you think that there's work that needs to be done, or is there, I'm just curious about that piece of it, because I think that's a really important part.
So, Chair Kinnegeyer and Representative Peterson, so I'm not exactly sure what qualifications. I know our HUD guidelines or HUD counselors have specific training to become HUD counselors, but I know the state has opened it up to counselors outside of just HUD. So we're not exactly sure of the qualifications of those that are outside of HUD counselors. And I'm not sure if it was done due to capacity issues or what exactly, why.
I think I can speak to hopefully two issues here. For counseling, the decision was made to expand the definition of HUD-approved counselor because there's actually no such thing as a HUD-approved counselor. There are HUD-approved agencies, and for some agencies, especially smaller agencies in rural areas, it doesn't make sense to go through the process of becoming a HUD-approved agency. So we made it more Oregon-specific. The statute now gives that authority to Oregon Housing and Community Services, and OHCS then made the decision to basically, if a counseling agency can show that they meet all of the HUD criteria to be an approved agency, so we then they can also participate in this program. It allowed many of the Eastern Oregon agencies that are not HUD approved to begin participating, but their counselors and their program still have to meet all the minimum thresholds that they would to become a HUD approved agency. For the facilitators, which is a slightly separate process, the statute, I believe, can't remember if it's statute or rule, so please don't quote me on that. The facilitators have to have very specific experience. So they have to have a certain number of hours of experience with mediation. They have to have, I believe, 16 hours of training in foreclosure-specific training and 8 hours at least in training specific to the OFA program. So that is all spelled out. And, you know, I think their counselors have had a really good experience, I think, with the facilitators by and large. It is a little bit of a hot-button issue at times, but there are certain decisions that are made as a part of the OFA process about whether documents were provided in a complete fashion, about whether the lender's representative had authority to negotiate. And, you know, sometimes we as counselors win those decisions, and sometimes we don't, and sometimes the lenders win those decisions, and sometimes we don't. But I would say that that's just a normal part of the negotiation process and not because the facilitators don't have adequate training or support or guidance in the program. We really feel like we've experienced a lot of expert facilitation and have been really pleased with that system.
And then just follow up. Yeah, thank you. And then just also on some of the recommendations that were given, you said you're starting to see kind of a lag in terms of scheduling just because of resources. Are those resources because Wells Fargo is having to dedicate a lot of resources to this more than was expected, or is it because there's not enough resources on the opposite end and there's a holdup on in terms of the people who are waiting to get part of the mediation process?
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, so the scheduling And I think DOJ can agree with me here, is we've acknowledged that there is a possibility of a loophole in regards to a borrower opt-in and the scheduling around the initial notice. At the time, there's time constraints in regards to when they need to have a scheduled conference. Some of the feedback we've received is due to availability of the housing counselors and trying to meet the needs of that scheduling constraints, as well as the time that they are paying their initial fee, being able to meet with a housing counselor, as well as bringing in all of their documentation. So all of that combined and the scheduling that happens up front is creating some scheduling conflicts and also leading to some reschedules that are now piling up. I will admit that Wells Fargo probably played a part in some of the scheduling constraints as when we came live in April of 2014, we initiated close to 1,600 cases in 1 month. And that may have led to this downward impact, but some of these suggestions that are coming today are not just for that. It's for other services that are coming on board to be prepared for what we might see, and that's why I alluded to the downstream impacts that it may cause in this process.
Chair Kennegeier, Representative Vega Peterson, I will echo that, yes, the Wells Fargo filing of 1,600 cases definitely created a bit of a scramble in the counseling community. But I just want to clarify a couple of points about the program, and that is that the client participation and their opt-in to the program is actually very, very clear in statute. They have the 25 days to pay their fee into the program, and that is their confirmation that they're participating. And that is a line in the sand. We have had clients who have mailed their payment a day late, or they mailed it accidentally to the wrong address, and they are not able to participate because they missed that fee deadline. So it is a very cut and dry kind of a process, and the 25-day timeline is non-negotiable. I would also just add that the first conference has to be scheduled within 75 days, also according to statute. There's only one option to reschedule, and it's either by the consent of both parties or within 30 days. So it's, again, a very carefully managed timeline. I would be absolutely open to conversation if the counseling schedule is somehow impacting that. But as far as I'm aware, on the counseling side of things, we have to fit them in within that timeline. There's no negotiation of that timeline for counseling. So that's created a bit of a scramble on our end. But as far as I know, the timelines of the program are the timelines of the program.
Yes, Representative Jordan.
Actually, this is a question probably more for the DOJ, and it doesn't deal with the counseling and so on, but since I have you all here, and it's an issue in my area, what do you do with foreclosed properties that have been empty for like 4, 5, 6 years? And when you call the phone number that's on the white piece of paper, you get a recording and you never get anything back? Is that a what can we do, not DOJ, to try to get some sort of information as to who owns the house, who is responsible, you know, that kind of thing. But we probably called a dozen times to the, you know, this is the number and this is what you're supposed to call, and always gotten a machine and never gotten a call back. It's not necessarily an institution itself, but more of a collection agency. So is that something that we need to talk about offline, or?
Representative Doherty, yes. I'm happy to follow up with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Yep, Representative Foley.
Just going back to this capacity issue, and I'm curious if Wells Fargo is, you know, kind of leveled out and seeing the trend of participation from their agency and or their company in the program is steady, declining, increasing. And in relationship to another large servicer coming on board, and all of a sudden there's another 1,600 in a month, you know, I hope that when you're in the asking for money that you're explaining the potential for that sort of a scenario. Because I think that's important for you to be able to project, you know, what your need is going forward.
Sure. Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Hovey, we have seen it level out. We are seeing it consistently between 250 to 300 customers per month, and after that initial influx back in April. So we are getting to a more consistent state month over month.
How long do you think that'll maintain that 200, 300 a month?
Our goal is to get modifications for all of these customers and that they continue to participate either through our internal efforts or through this mediation foreclosure avoidance program. So as delinquency rates continue to drop, we hope that we are able to help every Oregon citizen.
And Chair Kennegeier, Representative Hulvey, I think that's one of the reasons that it is working out well for counseling funding to be reevaluated every, 3 or 6 months,
mm-hmm.
Because there's a certain extent to which we can try to watch the trends and try to communicate with the lenders. But as I said, the timelines of the program are very set, and those don't change if there are 2,000 cases filed in a month. So there's also a certain extent to which we don't have a crystal ball. But we're trying to create the most adaptive network that we can, and we work very carefully as a network so that if there's an increase in filings in one county, another agency can step in and help provide phone counseling so that we can try to accommodate that demand. And we'll certainly be communicating with all of you about what we're seeing and what we need to keep the agency able to respond to that demand.
Just a quick follow-up. Is there any communication with the other large lenders that potentially could be coming online with this program as to what they're thinking, or whether or not they're going to drop 1,600 in 1 month, or?
Representative Hulvey, members of the committee, I don't communicate regularly with every large lender, but Bank of America is just coming online, and we actually are having regular phone calls with them. So I don't expect a 1,600 case in a month.
Knock on wood.
Influx.
Representative Hovey, members of the committee, in regards to your previous question around the consistency, well, now we are constantly evaluating the time that we initiate our cases, so that may have some variance in when we start this process. So the 250 to 300 that we are seeing on a monthly basis, it could drop should we change the time period that we are initiating our cases at, of delinquency. And we'll be in constant communication with both the DOJ and our housing counselors so that they can anticipate that. That's one of our learning opportunities initially.
Right, and just lastly, I'm hoping that your recommendations that you spoke of, that you're communicating those to DOJ to, you know, so that we can take a look at all those recommendations, you know, as this legislative body gets ready to bring more issues forward.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great panel. And now we've got Barry Pack and Sean McFadden, I think.
McFadden.
Thank you. So this is a follow-up on the implementation of two House bills that we passed, 4122 and 4135. Around technology. I'm sorry, Representative Vega Peterson is not here. She has a real interest in technology, but she will be coming back in a few minutes.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Lively and Richardson, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be with you today to give you an update on two items. I'll be with Barry Pack, who serves as the Deputy Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Administrative Services on the first item, which is 4122, and then Mr. Pack will take the discussion on House Bill 4135.
Okay.
And with that, I'll just start with just a brief overview of the purpose of House Bill 4122. Generally speaking, the purpose of that bill was to provide clear legislative direction to state contracting agencies and public corporations that information technology projects that met specific criteria were required to have independent performance reviews and ongoing quality assurance oversight. Certainly this bill came out of legislative concern over the handling of the health insurance exchange. There was a desire for the legislature to provide clear direction on the expectations moving forward. The second issue or purpose of House Bill 4122 was to indicate to those contracting agencies and public corporations that the legislature recognizes that over time independent procurement authority has been granted for a variety of purposes, but be that as it may, notwithstanding that independent procurement authority, that those state contracting agencies and public corporations were still expected and or were expected from the bill's passage forward to work with and to follow the rules, standards, and policies of the state chief information officer and the DAS director on the topic of ongoing quality assurance. With that said, I think the last significant portion of 4122 really attempted to deal with awareness by executives of the quality assurance report findings, risks associated with projects, and the bill itself prescribed a specific set of distribution points. And so it identifies a required set of parties that must receive copies of these quality assurance reports at the same time that they're distributed to the state contracting agency's contract administrator. And that includes the state chief information officer, the director of the Department of Administrative Services, and as appropriate for the specific IT initiative, the director of the state contracting agency. If it's a board, the reports need to be sent to that board or commission, or if it's a public corporation, the reports are expected to be sent to the full governing body of that public corporation. Generally speaking, that's what the bill was intended to do, and we've been working with the Department of Administrative Services and the State Chief Information Officer and the agencies that are subject to this particular bill since the bill's passage in March, April timeframe. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Barry Pack, and he can talk a little bit about our joint efforts, and I'll interject as needed.
Thank you, Sean. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Chief Operating Officer and for the state at the Department of Administrative Services. I want to hit just a couple of highlights on the implementation and to first apologize for being a subpar substitute for the state CIO, Alex Pettit, who was originally invited to testify, but unfortunately had a pre-scheduled event out of state that he could not get out of. So I'm going to do my best to fill in for him and hit the highlights that he wanted me to pass along to you in terms of implementation. First being
as Mr. McSpadden referenced, we've been working since the passage of the bill and Alex's tenure with us very closely with the Legislative Fiscal Office to develop some joint oversight practices and policies so that we're working in tandem, hand in hand, to get the kind of information and oversight we need. And I'll talk a little bit more about how that works and is looking as we move on to 4135, which deals more with the state CIO and his responsibilities and oversight. But appreciate the support and the work from LFO on that. We have been updating our policy on quality assurance, quality control for state agencies to align it to the bill. We've put a lot of work into that policy. It's gone through, we're calling it version 2, but it's actually gone through 12 different iterations as we get feedback from LFO, from agencies, from our own policy analysts who provide oversight, and then also engaging experts out in the private sector in the quality assurance and quality control world to make sure that we're thinking about things the right way and approaching the policy, which provides agency the direction on how to implement this. We've also, through some of this work, done an inventory and a categorization of IT projects out there. When we began this journey, and I'll quote Senator Johnson from the Emergency Board this morning, we all are living in the shadow of Cover Oregon at this time, and so there's a lot of scrutiny being applied to IT projects, rightly so. When we began that scrutiny, we were tracking 18 what we called major IT projects. And when we did the all call out to agencies to try to get our arms around exactly what was out there, setting the bar at $1 million with some of the other thresholds that are similar to the QA criteria that are included in the bill, we now have a list of about 70 IT projects. 32, 35 of them, depending upon how you categorize them, are in flight, meaning they're active, they're engaged, and about, I think, 18 to 20 of them are in the planning stages, so they'll start moving into the initiation. And the rest are just ideas out there that need some attention, and we'll begin the process shortly. So those projects are getting a pretty large amount of scrutiny, both from their own QA contractors, but from the CIO's office and from LFO's office. And we'll continue to work on that as we move forward. I think those are the highlights that we wanted to emphasize for you. The policy is putting a little more rigor around some of the definitions, so we're very clear for state agencies what projects count and qualify at what point in time and how they can evaluate the quality assurance. The statute did give the CIO some authority to determine some of these variables because risk in a project is not just defined by cost. It can be defined by how large your scope is, for instance, or how new the technology is that you're using. And so you could have a large dollar project that has actually very little risk other than the dollar side. And so giving some parameters around the level of quality assurance that's required based on some of those categories. So those are the things we're considering in the policy. It is ready, I believe, to go to the Department of Justice for their review, and we'll be implementing it upon their recommendations. Anything to add, Mr. McSpadden?
Sure. Chair Kenegeyer, Vice Chairs Richardson and Lively. Forgive me, but I think when I started out discussing 4122, I may have forgotten to introduce myself for the record. So for the record, my name is Sean McSpadden. I serve as one of two principal legislative information technology analysts within the Legislative Fiscal Office. And again, I'll just with that pick up the conversation. In addition to the quality assurance policy needing to be updated, as Mr. Pack indicated, it likely required an update in any case, whether the bill had passed or not. The current quality assurance policy was put in place in 2004. There have been significant reorganizations within the Department of Administrative Services. Those kinds of updates, administrative changes of names, and certainly a focused effort on alignment of the policy with the requirements of House Bill 4122. Are part of that effort. In addition to the policy, certainly there is a need for the state CIO's office, and we're helping as appropriate to review the existing quality assurance contracts. As Mr. Peck indicated, at the time of the inventory, there were 18 major IT projects that both of our organizations were tracking. They have independent quality assurance vendors on board. And some of these requirements about the distribution of reports, about the specific standards that these quality assurance contractors need to utilize in overseeing these projects, needed to be updated. And so this Office of the State CIO is taking a look at the in-flight projects, making sure that there's alignment there. And then of course, any new quality assurance contracts are being written from the beginning, from the start, to align with House Bill 4122. In addition, there's an effort, you may or may not know, the state does have a master QA services contract. It is a contract within which a group of 11 qualified firms are available to state agencies. About 2009, that agreement was put in place with the recognition that this is a much needed service, that it didn't make sense for agencies that were initiating a major IT project to have to kind of figure it out all on their own. They needed some assistance in knowing which firms were qualified, and certainly it helped to have all 11 firms familiar with the state's processes so that they could get moving quickly. That particular QA master services contract is under review, and possibly one of the actions the state CIO may take is to rebid that contract to, one, freshen the pool of vendors, but also, again, to make sure we have more standardization, more normalization of the kinds of activities of these QA contractors and the kinds of reports that they produce. Another key item that was just heard early today in the e-board was a series of requests by the Department of Administrative Services to gain the or to transfer expenditure limitation from one program to another to allow the State Chief Information Officer to purchase something called a project and portfolio management system. You may not be surprised that these very, very large projects, one, are very large in dollar amount, second, are complex, and third, they do travel over time. As an example, the Medicaid Management Information System project a few years ago took 8 years from initiation to completion. And so the ability to track the information that's needed for oversight, needed for review, needed for just general management manually in the form of paper documents and spreadsheets almost becomes an impossible task. And so this kind of system is incredibly important. It is one that we'll be working with the Office of the State CIO on implementation over the next six to nine months. I think the last thing that I'd mention is that just in terms of process, in May, Dr. Pettit and I came before the Joint Committee on Legislative Audits and Information Management Technology. We, I'll say, presented our work on a joint State CIO and Legislative Fiscal Office stage gate review process. What that does is it makes sure that agencies know that whether it's the Office of the State CIO or the Legislative Fiscal Office, that we have a standards set of criteria, some common expectations of agencies and of the QA contractors, so that there aren't separate rules of the road. We wanted to lessen confusion on the part of the agency, but also make sure that we were standardized across the branches. And so we've been implementing that particular process on projects that exceed $150,000 on the state CIO side, and certainly any very, very large projects on our side for the legislative branch.
Do you want me to ask at this point?
Do you want to mention it, or would you like to mention?
Go ahead.
So we were just going to mention that there are a couple legislative concepts that people are working on to streamline the IT process and to clarify authority. They weren't ready to be committee bills at this point. So thank you for raising those issues, and we look forward to continuing to work with you on them.
Is there anything you want to add to that?
And that we are working with the with DAS personnel on the language of those bills.
Right.
Great.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. McSpain?
No, I'd just like to acknowledge the work that DAS and our Sean McSpadden from LFO have put into continuing to work on this and to fine-tune it to make sure it works for, you know, for everyone. So I know it's been a yeoman's work. A lot has gone into it, and I know that we'll be looking at some more of that. So thanks a lot.
Yes.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hall, we also wanted to recognize Bob Cummings from our office. He and I work as partners in this. Again, with a portfolio of projects this large, it's impossible for one person to do it, and very, very difficult for two. And so Bob certainly has been integral to this process. And, of course, we appreciate the analyst staff that work for the Office of the State CIO. We try to work as much as we can in partnership.
Well, that's a good segue.
All right.
Into 4135. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there's a PowerPoint that is working its way up. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about how 4135 relates to how Oregon is updating its management of technology. And I'll walk through a couple of things, if I can figure out how to. So from a high-level overview of what the bill did, it directed the CIO to advise the executives, staff of state agencies on technology policy, about current trends in technology and about best practices, best use. It charged the CIO to identify multi-agency technology initiatives where there could be increased coordination for reducing duplication and fragmentation. It directed him to establish some governance structures for the investment in and acquisition and deployment of technology. It gave the state CIO authority to review agency technology plans and budgets and to make sure that they're aligned to both the state's overall information resource management plan, but also individual state agency strategic plans. It charged the state CIO to track and monitor IT projects. As you've heard, we've now got a list of 70, and as Sean mentioned earlier, approval now, and we've purchased a project portfolio management tool to track those in a central location. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. And then also charged the CIO to provide information, guidance, and support to agencies to implement cost-effective and efficient technology initiatives. This sort of set of directions is scheduled to sunset June 30 of next year, and the CIO and DAS is directed to come forward to the legislature with recommendations and a budget for how to carry the work on based on our experience. We asked for that sunset because we wanted the ability to test out some different models of governance and of oversight. And if we didn't want to put them all in statute right away, because if they didn't work, then we'd have to come back and come up with something else. We wanted to test it out as a pilot and then come to you next year with some recommendations. So implementation progress to date, again, at a really high level. We began the work to identify a stronger governance structure before House Bill 4135 was adopted by the legislature, and then we continued that work, adapted based on the direction given to us in the legislation, and then began a pilot project to implement some of that work. We chartered it officially as a project, just as we've done with some of the other initiatives that we've reported to you on in the past, facilities leasing, for instance, payroll consolidation. So they have we have a multi-agency steering team on the project. We have a clear charter of definition and outcome scopes, project plan, all that sort of the same rigor that we would apply to any project is being applied here. We've collaborated with LFO, as we mentioned earlier, on the 4122 discussion on an oversight process and the stage gate process. We're currently conducting a technology services assessment to get a better sense of what the technology needs for what we will call utility services by state agencies actually is, comparing that to the service catalog that's currently being provided either by Enterprise Technology Services at DAS or by other service providers, and look for a set of recommendations on moving forward. And then, again, we have a policy option package in the governor's budget to continue and expand this pilot.
I wanted to spend a quick minute talking about governance because it means a lot of things to a lot of people, and in the IT world, it means something very specific. And I've got a slide that Alex created for me because he's far more competent in PowerPoint than I am that helps illustrate the importance of governance. He talks about it as preventing de-evolution of shared services through governance. And what happens is, as an entity, a very large organization, we set up a list of requirements for an IT system. And they're all aligned, and everyone agrees, and it's a very narrow set of scope, and it works. But over time, things change. Agency business needs change, technology changes, requirements change. But we never had a process by which to organize that. And so what happened then is agencies started creating workarounds or shadow systems or acquiring other systems that lay on top of what had been a unified, consistent, statewide application. And what results is duplication, fragmentation. It's costly. We have lots of staff chasing a lot of applications we don't necessarily need. Or if they were done in a different way, we could reallocate some of that resource to do other things. So the importance of governance then is to create an environment and a structure by which all of those can get pulled back in together again. Michael Jordan, state CEO, was very fond of saying a year ago, we can't even make a bad decision as it relates to IT because we had no process to make a decision. We had no place to go to set some structure and some boundaries. What we've done through some of the work of 4135 is create a process to make some of those decisions. The other way to think about governance is the sort of the three questions: who gets, who pays, and who decides. And so when we start thinking about IT systems, if you look at this inverse pyramid at the bottom, there are utility functions. These are things that every agency needs regardless of what their book of business is. Telephones, email, network connections, all those sorts of things. And our idea in the governance structure is that should be governed at an enterprise-wide level. There should be not just a single person, although the state CIO has that authority. He is delegating some of that authority to input from an enterprise governing body to help make those decisions. At the top of the inverted pyramid are agency-specific functions and processes, right? These are things that an individual agency needs to do their business, and it may not be applicable to any other agency. Trip check at ODOT, right? It's a very sophisticated road system. It's beneficial to other agencies. I use it. I'm a commuter to Portland. I check it on my way home. But it's not necessarily something that the Department of Revenue has any need to use for its business processes. So in a governance structure, those decisions really need to be made by the agency business leaders and that agency CIO. The part in the middle is a gray area where we don't do very well, but we're really focusing in on improving, and that is, where are there opportunities for a shared service? Licensing is a great example. The process of licensing someone either for a business or for a recreational activity is largely the same. There's an application, there may be a background check, there's a review by staff, there's payment of a fee, and then there's the issuing of a license. It doesn't really matter whether it's a fishing license or a pilot's license. The process is the same. The requirements around the business are different, but the process is the same. And so part of our governance structure is creating opportunities through the state CIO's office to look for where there is commonality among agencies, a common business need. I have the business need for an online licensing tool. In the past, that agency would have just gone and built it themselves. What we're trying to create is a structure and the capacity to say, wait a minute, we've got an agency over here who already has a very workable licensing system. Let's see if we can't make it work for your needs. Or when we've got an agency ready to build an application to support a business process that we think is likely to be shared, to work with that agency to make sure they develop it in such a way that it could easily be transported or translated over to another agency. So again, we're looking for ways to reduce the amount of duplication and fragmentation, look for a shared service opportunity, and we have not had that capacity in the past.
May I ask a question?
Yes, yeah. Please, Representative Richardson.
So certainly this is absolutely necessary. There are hundreds of software applications. My understanding when I looked at this a few years ago was that there was no ability for if there was a CIO, to know what was going on throughout the government because there was no ability to communicate. There was no software platform consistency. And while you're looking at it, how will you go about enabling you to have proper oversight because you'll create an ability to actually see what's going on?
Yeah, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Richardson, that's a good question. That goes back to the Project Portfolio Management tool. So that is an application that all agencies will have access to. They will enter their project information into it. And we will have access to it in the CIO's office. LFO will be able to see what the projects are in there. We'll be able to track them over time. You can also use it in a mature governance structure. An organization would enter all of their ideas even into a portfolio management system so that you can make prioritization decisions. When you've got limited resources, which we all do, and you have business needs that outpace your resources, you have to make choices, and you have to know what you're not going to do. If you reprioritize this project, you have to know what you're not going to do. So you track the ideas, you track your in-flight projects, you track your emergency requests or something breaks and you've got to move resource away. So you can actually see that in one central location. Moving on, this chart just sort of shows a concept that we are piloting in the state CIO's office. It's part of our policy option package in the governor's office, and it is largely built around this concept of strategic technology officers. They are companions to the policy analysts that currently exist in the CIO's office. The policy analysts are the oversight. The technology officers are the brokers, the educators, the folks who are out there in the agency business, learning their business need, helping them translate that business need into a technology solution. One of the things that has happened too often in the past is technology drove business decisions. What needs to happen in a mature organization is the business drives the technology. The business sets the needs and the outcomes. Technology is a tool to help you get there. So what we would like to be doing is pairing a policy analyst and a technology officer into the six sort of standard policy areas that you're probably familiar with. This is generally speaking how the legislature has looked at agencies for budgeting. We've smushed transportation and economic development into one, so only have six instead of seven or eight. And assigning these people out to the agencies to facilitate conversations between sort of the team of players you see there, governor's policy advisors, the business leaders in the agency programs, the agency CIOs, their procurement shops, legislative fiscal, chief financial office, other partners, community stakeholders, all that sort of thing. These are the people who will provide the capability and the capacity to identify where we have duplication, where we have initiatives that could go into a shared service model or become an enterprise utility model. What we hope and expect to get out of this, increased IT compliance and coordination, reduced system duplication, technology solutions that are more closely aligned to the business, and a streamlined portfolio management. Here's where we are today. We have three technology officers on rotation from agencies. So these are agency people who are on loan to us, who are experienced in technology, but also are very good at facilitating good solutions. The roles and responsibilities between the policy analysts, who, as I said, are more on the oversight side, and the technology officers have been aligned. They're out there working in agencies and with LFO and our analysts on IT projects. We're coordinating shared services already. We've procured, these bullets are a little out of date since it's now December. We have purchased the portfolio management tool I talked about, and we're working on the workflow and processes to implement it. I wanted to spend just a couple minutes talking about the stage gate in case you haven't seen it or heard about it, because it's been all over the last few months, but this is a very high-level view. Again, as Sean mentioned earlier, we did partner with LFO on developing this oversight model Alex brought to us. These stage gates will be added into the portfolio management tool so that when you go in, we will be able to see where a project is along the stage gate process.
There's nothing magical to the stage gate process other than it sets some hard deadlines for incremental delivery of a project. So stage one is very high-level planning. When you get there, it's sort of the 50% plan. There's a hard stop for evaluation as to whether or not the project's ready to move forward. Gets to the detailed business case and foundational planning. You're at your 90% plan. Again, another stage gate, stop point for moving forward. Detailed planning, and then it's execution. One of the things that I think is really important, and I want to express my appreciation to the LFO staff, both Sean and Bob, is we are working on this process jointly so that it is one process with one set of forms and one set of expectations so that agencies don't have to go through it twice and they know what they're going to expect from us and what they're going to expect from LFO. And we are working now on the common project templates for each of these stages, and we're working with agency staff throughout the breadth of the government to come up with those so that they are involved in the creation of the project documents and templates. So that's a very high-level view of the stage gate. I talked a little bit earlier about the technology review. The basic objective of that is to determine what are our true utility services that should be governed at the enterprise level, and then figure out how best to provide that service. We utilized a work group structure of SWAT teams. We had over 60 members of state agencies participating. They're both business and technology people, again, aligning business with the technology. Their recommendations are under development, and we'll move through a series of discussion and decision-making about how we might want to move forward in the biennia ahead. Any changes in the way we currently provide some of these services, like network or phones, for instance, takes a lot of planning to be able to implement a change. We're in the process of moving our telecom services out of state management into a third-party private vendor. We're in a procurement process for that. It's a multi-year plan, so any of these changes aren't going to happen overnight. We're not flipping a switch, but we're trying to take a second look at how we're actually providing services across the state. And then finally, I just wanted to mention the policy option package. We will be coming forward with the governor's budget. It's roughly $2.6 million additional dollars for the state CIO's office, 12 new positions. We think this is what we need initially based on what we know now to provide the kind of oversight and support that's necessary, both support for large agencies, but in particular small agencies. We've had this conversation with Representative Vega Peterson before, agencies who don't have the resources or capacity to really identify what their need is, let alone evaluate whether the solution they've selected is the right one. So this is a combination of policy analysts, the technology officers, an enterprise business architect to help us sort of map out what our systems are, and some business analysts to help provide that sort of business analysis needs and process mapping that agencies may not have, as well as, I think, one support position in there. So that, I believe, yes, is the end of my presentation.
Great.
And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We'll take a couple of questions, and then we need to move to our work session. But Representative Richardson.
Thank you. How do you propose to maintain your independence over time in working with Cover Oregon at the beginning? It was a game between Cover Oregon, the Oregon Health Authority, and LFO's oversight capability. They resisted, they hid stuff, they did not cooperate, and there's a lot of pressure in the executive branch to go along instead of becoming an obstacle. And so how are you going to be able to withstand that kind of pressure, which is inevitable?
Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, I guess I would answer it in a couple of ways. One, my expectation is you all will be holding us accountable to maintain that independence, and so we will have some pressure to work on that ourselves. I think second, one difference in the governance structure that we've put in place is agencies are as invested in the success of it as we are. And so it lessens the incentive to hide when you are holding each other jointly accountable. And then, frankly, the DAS director and the state CIO have an awful lot of authority in statute to make some decisions that have not necessarily been utilized in the past. And I think you're going to see that now in order to make sure that we've got the adequate oversight. Now, the question about how long does that last over time, I think part of that also involves the personalities that are involved. As you get to know Mr. Pettit, you'll see that he's a straight talker and he doesn't put up with a lot of games. And so I think we're going to establish a set of expectations and a course of action that agencies are forthcoming, and they have been, frankly, over the last year.
That's probably because of the fallout from Cover Oregon, but you'd be amazed at how short the memories are of those kinds of things after we move on. I just hope that your credibility and objectivity will remain because you'll be able to do your job without being subject to the pressures of those that you get to be friends with who are doing things that may not be absolutely the way you want them to be. Anyway, thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you so
much.
Thank you. Well, we're going to be hearing a lot more of this in the next session, I recognize. Okay, so I'm going to close the informational hearing for the Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency and open a work hearing with the purpose of forwarding for your approval a slate of LCs to be submitted by the committee. And I want to say, with, I'm sure you've heard this in every committee so far, that this does not mean that you necessarily support these legislative concepts. They are an OLIS, but that you are willing for them to, as a committee, hear them to go forward with the discussion for the next session. They may be assigned to our committee or they may be assigned to a different committee. So with that said, could I please have my vice chair?
Okay. Chair Tegeyer, I move that Legislative Council number 1461, dated October 31, 2014, as well as LC 1592, dated November 3rd, 2014, and LC 1766, dated November 3, 2014, LC 2160, dated December 4, 2014, LC 2209, dated October 28, 2014, LC 2216, dated December 4, 2014, LC 2290, dated October 31, 2014, LC 2321, dated October 14, 2014, LC 2414, dated November 12th, 2014, LC 2572, dated November 13th, 2014, and LC 2630, dated November 13th, 2014, be introduced as committee bills.
Okay, Representative Richardson moves that LC 1461, dated October 31st, 2014, LC 1592, dated November 3rd, 2014, LC 1766, dated November 3rd, 2014, LC 2160, dated December 4th, 2014, LC 2209, dated October 28th, 2014, LC 2216, dated December 4th, 2014, LC 2290, dated October 31st, 2014, LC 2321, dated October 14th, 2014, LC 2414, dated November 12, 2014, LC 2572, dated November 13, 2014, and LC 2630, dated November 13, 2014, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there an objection? If not, these measures are introduced as committee bills. And with that, I close the work session, and I just want to add what a pleasure it's been to serve in my first interim chair position. I want to thank the former chair. I want to thank our committee administrator, Jan Nordland, and I want to thank everyone on the committee. I've learned a tremendous amount in the last 2 years, and I particularly want to do some very well wishes for next adventures for Representative Thatcher, Representative Richardson, on to new adventures.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, Miss, this is your last committee in the House, for at least for now.
I'm so glad I didn't end on the update of amendments to the UGB bill yesterday. That was putting me to sleep. So this was a much better ending. Thank you.
Yeah. There was some good movement forward, I thought, out of those panels today. So work to be done, but good movement forward.
Oh my gosh.
So thank you all. Thank you for your service.
Crying my eyes open.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah, you won't be on any more committees with me, Kim.
Well, you never know.
Well, that's true.
You never know. Joint
committee? I don't do joint committees.
You don't do joint committees.
That'd be about as exciting.
Oh, and I now close the...
That'd be about as exciting.
Oh, and I now close the...